Welcome to the Tech Policy Podcast. I'm Evan Schwartzschrauber. On today's show, is the NSA checking itself before it wrecks itself? Last Friday, NSA announced that it's ending certain surveillance known as About Collection. And I've got two of my favorite commenters on privacy issues here to explain what the hell that is and should anyone care. So joining me to discuss this is Nima Guliani, Legislative Counsel at the ACLU, that's the American Civil Liberties Union here in D.C., and Liza Goitin, Co-Director of the Brennan Center for Justice, Liberty, and National Security Program. Ladies, thanks so much for joining.
Thanks for having us.
My pleasure.
So before we jump into a policy discussion, can one of you explain what it is, what it means to say about collection?
About collection is a component of upstream collection. And upstream collection is when the NSA is siphoning communications off of the internet backbone while they are in transit. And they do that by scanning all of the traffic, all the international traffic that goes across the internet backbone for certain selectors that are associated with the targets. And selectors are often described as things like email addresses, although it could be almost anything else. We don't really know much about it. So anyway, the NSA scans all of the communications for the selector associated with the target. But what happens with about collection is that they are picking up pretty much any transaction that includes the selector. So it isn't necessarily just communications to or from the target. It includes communications that merely mention the selector associated with the target.
And when we say the internet backbone, and we're talking in the international context with the NSA, is this a lot of underwater cables that travel between countries? Are they, when I send the message to Europe, it's in that moment where it's traveling between the continents that they pick it up? That's what we mean by upstream?
Well, it's technically on U.S. soil. It's the part of the internet backbone that's coming into the United States. So as the communications are coming into the United States or out of the United States, it's that part of the infrastructure that's being captured, because this we're talking about Section 702 of FISA, and that only applies when the NSA is doing its collection from technically within the United States. So
right.
The NSA is collecting all this stuff from other parts of the internet infrastructure overseas, or even sort of in the middle of the ocean, then the NSA is working under a totally different authority with much fewer legal restrictions.
And I think it's really important to emphasize that the only reason this collection happens is because the NSA and the government have engaged in a sort of legal gymnastics to justify it. If you look at the text of the statute, it very clearly says that they can only collect information to or from the target that they have overseas, the individual they're surveilling. But through a series of legal opinions that frankly don't necessarily line up with the intent of many of the people who wrote the legislation, authorized the legislation, the NSA has said that they can collect information not just to or from those targets, but about those targets. So let's say I, for example, am emailing Liza, and we happen to use, you know, a selector associated with one of those targets. Let's say an email address. The NSA is surveilling a journalist, and I send Liza the email address of that journalist or mention the name. Our communication may be picked up even though we are two Americans simply communicating about someone who happens to be a target of the NSA. And that, I think, is a real problem, is not consistent with what many people thought was the purpose of the statute.
Now, what is the end result? So the NSA does all of this collection. It stores the data. Have they created kind of like a Google search function here? I mean, I know that it's hard to know exactly how they operate because it's naturally a secrecy-based organization, but is it as simple as essentially going, Nima, here's an email address from a journalist, terrorism, and then it pulls up results like a Google search and they're essentially searching the content of messages? Or like, I'm just trying to get a sense of how do they gather the information, how do they store it, and then how do they search it?
So the way they gather the information is actually kind of alarming, really, because in order to avoid slowing down internet traffic, or at least that's supposedly the rationale, they actually take a snapshot. They copy all of that internet traffic as it's going through, and they temporarily seize it and hold it and scan all of it in order to find the communications that include the selectors that they're looking for.
That delay would be unnoticeable to any human, right? I mean, are we talking like a couple extra seconds here?
Well, my point is that it's to avoid any such delay. So to avoid the delay, they actually copy the data as it's transiting and they hold it somewhere else. And we don't know how long they hold it. I mean, there are some reports that it may be seconds, but we don't know, actually. That information is not publicly available. But for some temporary period of time, all of that data is seized and held by or on behalf of the NSA so that it can all be scanned. And the content of this data is all scanned for the selectors.
And then, you know, Nima brings up that point where people unrelated to an investigation, they're having their communication swept in. Does NSA then proactively delete the unnecessary information, or do they just hold on to it? And is that part of the problem? And we've talked about Section 702 on previous episodes. And the reason I bring up the Google analogy, I know that's not actually how it works, so listeners, calm down. But is it that the FBI can then search this information? I'm just trying to get a sense of, you know, if the NSA has a legitimate investigative function, that's not necessarily what people should be opposing, but it's that incidental collection of other people that gets wrapped up. Are they deleting that? Are they then able to search that for other purposes? How much do we know about how this kind of program operates?
So I think there's sort of, you know, packed into your questions, two concerns really emerge. The first is, you know, whether what they're doing is legitimate to begin with. When you look at Section 702 and you look at the individuals they target, it goes far beyond terrorism. You're not just talking about terrorism suspects or individuals for whom their suspicion have been engaged in sort of some activity that would indicate they're a threat to national security. You're talking about, let's say, a journalist who investigates drones. Let's say a business owner who happens to be communicating about political affairs. Let's say a regular citizen who just happens to be very interested in what's happening on in the world. All these individuals could be swept up under Section 702 surveillance. Once their information is collected, including their communications with individuals in the U.S., the default retention period for that information is 5 years. And I think it's really important to talk about kind of the scope of collection we're talking about. According to the opinions of the FISA court, we're talking about hundreds of millions of communications being collected annually. With a default period of 5 years, you know, it's conservative to estimate that the government at any given time may be holding on to, you know, half a billion to a billion communications. Once they have this information, the FBI and other agencies assert the right to search through this information, not just for information about whoever that foreign target was, but also for information about U.S. citizens and residents who may have been in communication with that target. So let's just put a concrete example on this. Let's say the FBI is investigating a completely domestic crime. Let's say something related to drug trafficking within the U.S. As part of the initial stages of that investigation, they search through databases that contain information collected under the surveillance authority. And they may search through this database, let's say with my name or your name, just to see what comes up and what pops up. And I think that, you know, for many people, myself included, is very concerning. You have information collected in bulk, without a warrant, without any individualized suspicion. And then in purely domestic crimes that have nothing to do with national security, you have the FBI and other federal agencies essentially using that information for purposes that exceed the purpose for which it was collected. And that, I think, really encapsulates a lot of the concerns about this program and the overbreadth.
And we very rarely see intelligence agencies giving up a tool voluntarily or changing their practices in response to privacy advocacy. I mean, I think those of us in the privacy community would like to see a lot more of internal reforms in response to the various campaigns we run, but it's rare. I mean, it's not been many years of good news on that front. So people might have been scratching their heads at this because the refrain from the intelligence community, from a lot of lawyers who work at firms that represent the intelligence community, it's always been, look, you might have had thoughts about that bulk collection Section 215 mass domestic surveillance program. That's not what we're talking about here. Section 702 is a legitimate surveillance tool. This is used for foreign intelligence. Every country does stuff like this, and that it's prevented terrorist attacks. And now you've got the NSA saying that they're not going to do about collection anymore. And their statement alludes to some, quote, inadvertent compliance incidents related to queries involving U.S. person information in 702 upstream internet collection. And then that caused them to have delays in their court approvals. Is that what's going on here? Are they actually concerned about the stuff that Nima just said about Americans' communications being swept up?
Well, first of all, I want to challenge your premise that Section 702 is standard basic surveillance that's not controversial at all. We have to remember the origins of this law. This was what Congress did in 2008, following up on a similar law in 2007, to legalize President Bush's warrantless wiretapping program. This was a program that Bush undertook in secret because it was illegal, because it was considered to be unconstitutional. And it was a scandal when it was revealed. But times change very quickly. And instead of actually coming down pretty hard on the administration for violating the statute and the Constitution, Congress decided that it would try to legalize the warrantless wiretapping through the FISA Amendments Act. So I don't think it's fair, even though people have become accustomed to it. And yes, you have intelligence officials coming before Congress consistently to testify, nothing to see here. This is standard basic surveillance. It's useful. No one should have any concerns. There are a lot of reasons to be concerned, starting with the fact that Americans' communications are being listened to and read without a warrant. So I just need to challenge that premise. But to get to your ultimate question there, no, the NSA did not do this out of the goodness of its heart or out of a sudden newfound concern for civil liberties. The issue was that the court was balking at reauthorizing Section 702 for another year because the NSA was belatedly reporting several compliance incidents that had happened over recent years in which the NSA failed to adhere to limits that the court had set on how to handle data that's collected under upstream collection.
And what are some of those limits? I mean, we don't have to get too technical, but I mean, we're not talking about a run-of-the-mill court here. We're talking about the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, which the average person doesn't get to see much of. And when that court, which many have criticized as being too rubber stamp and too much of a, yes, the NSA can do whatever it wants, when that court is starting to ask questions, that might be a good sign for civil liberties. But what are some of these limits that NSA had imposed by the court that they failed to adhere to, and now they're realizing that and reporting them as compliance incidents?
Because about collection and upstream collection in general is more likely than the other type of collection, which is called PRISM, and that's where stored communications are obtained from servers, from the companies that store the communications.
Is it oversimplification to say that that's downstream?
You could call it downstream. I think NSA is now trying to call it downstream. Previously, it's always been called PRISM.
Right.
But anyway, because upstream collection is more likely to obtain purely domestic communications, there were some very strict limits on how upstream collection and certain components of upstream collection could be handled. So any sort of packets or bundles of communications that were transiting together, including something called multi-communication transactions or MCTs, had to be segregated out and examined in a certain way. They needed to be held for a shorter period of time. And there were limits on querying this data. U.S. person queries, where the FBI, the NSA, the CIA can actually look through raw Section 702 data for information about Americans, those could not be done on data obtained through upstream. So there were a number of restrictions like that because of this increased risk that you had a bunch of purely domestic communications in the data set. And apparently it was those limits that were being on multiple occasions flouted, or, you know, inadvertently flouted, but flouted nonetheless.
Yeah, and I think it's important to emphasize, we don't have the compliance reports from the NSA. So, I mean, you know, part of what we're doing is trying to connect the dots based on, you know, a couple of statements in a press release. You know, to date, we don't have the FISA court opinion raising concerns about these compliance issues. The public has never seen what the actual compliance issues are. So we don't have a sense of the scope. But clearly they were significant enough that, as you said, a court that has routinely approved this program started to raise red flags.
And is it too early to celebrate? I mean, this looks like good news in some ways, right? So, you know, one of the arguments that we make is that we cannot trust the NSA to to check itself, to reform its practices. Here's an example of the NSA disarming itself in a way that we've said the practice was bad, that they were basically collecting a bunch of Americans' information, not complying with the limits imposed. There was public pressure, maybe the court applied some pressure, and now they've changed their practice. I mean, is that an example of how the intelligence community can actually self-regulate, or is this just cleaning house so that they can get the program reauthorized and then go back to business as usual?
So, you know, I certainly wasn't pulling out my party hat when I saw this release.
I would like to see that party hat.
I would too.
It's fabulous. You know, if you look at what the NSA said, they didn't say, look, we're changing our legal theory. We're concerned about the multitude of civil rights and civil liberties issues that have been raised about this collection. What they said is, we're having some technical problems complying with the court. Since essentially the court won't approve our program with these technical issues, we are going to stop doing this collection. But they're very clear to assert that they had the legal authority to do it. And so what that means is it can be restarted at any time for which they think that they can comply with these technical requirements or can convince the court that they can comply with these technical requirements, they can certainly restart it. And so I don't think this is a good example to say, look, the NSA can regulate itself. You know, the courts and Congress don't need to step in. I think what it shows is that more than ever, Congress does need to step in, and Congress needs to put clear limits in the statute that prevent a ballot collection from ever being resumed, and also put in place a multitude of other protections that right now don't exist. You know, in some senses, it's very shocking that the NSA had compliance issues for at least a year, but the program continued. To me, that's just evidence of the need for more oversight, more limits, and certainly more transparency.
And let's not forget that about collection is one component of upstream collection, which is less than 10% of all of the collection that the NSA does under Section 702 of FISA, which is not the biggest surveillance authority that the NSA uses.
So we're talking about a tiny piece of the pie here. So they've maybe affected a small percentage of their surveillance, even under the authority that we're debating whether or not to renew.
That's absolutely right. And I don't want to say that it's not important. It is. About collection is one of the issues that privacy and civil liberties advocates have been extremely concerned about, but it's one of many such issues. And the sad fact is that we have expanded surveillance authorities so dramatically and so quickly and so recklessly that at this point, in order to restore a sensible balance, there's a lot to do. And even though this is an important change, it's really one of many changes. And it's a change that Congress needs to reinforce, because otherwise, as Nima said, it's going to be quite temporary.
Some have suggested that this is not just about the pressure they face from the court or that argument, that it's also about consumer behavior and businesses having changed their behavior. And it may not seem like it to a lot of people, but people did change their behavior after the Snowden leaks in 2013. There was increased adoption of encrypted messaging and things like that. And maybe if you're not one of those people that did that, you haven't seen the change, but some estimates said something like 700 million people worldwide did something in response to the Snowden leaks. And one of our colleagues has suggested that because people are now using a more encryption, that NSA is having more of a hard time collecting the information, or when they do collect it, it's not usable, so it's a waste of space. We're talking about STARTTLS. I like to call it STARTLS, but I think most people in this community call it TTLS, encryption of communications between email servers. Is that part of it, and that they now have to do the other methods like downstream, serving subpoenas, showing up at a server farm with a national security letter, other forms of surveillance? Is it harder for them to get useful data because of encryption?
I mean, the one thing I would say is that the NSA doesn't give up capabilities if it doesn't have another way of getting what it's looking for. So it's certainly a possibility that that's one of the reasons why the NSA was more willing to put a temporary halt, at least, to about collection, was because Yes, because of encryption, and not just as a result of Snowden, obviously, but because people are becoming more aware of the vulnerability of data based on a lot of the high-profile hacks that have happened and other factors as well. So yes, encryption is becoming more and more standard, and that means that when the NSA picks up communications in transit, those communications are more likely to be unreadable, whereas if they get the encryption at one end where it's being stored and it's been decrypted, then the NSA can read it. So certainly it's possible that Prism is becoming more and more valuable and Upstream is becoming less and less valuable. But another thing to consider is that the NSA can also just switch to overseas internet cables.
You read my mind. I was going to ask the next question.
I mean, if they haven't already, I mean, they probably are doing a fair amount of about collection already under Executive Order 12333, which is where the NSA does its tapping into the internet overseas.
Right. And you said they don't give up a capability if they don't have it elsewhere. And you might say the same thing for a legal authority. You wouldn't give up a legal authority if you couldn't find that same legal authority elsewhere. So can we even be sure that this is a meaningful reform if they can just do the exact same thing under 12333, which technically means it has to originate outside of the United States, but we have surveillance partners. We have other countries that have done work for us in that regard. So, I mean, is it possible that this doesn't change anything at all?
Well, it certainly changes something, because if this defaults to 12333, then all of a sudden you have less oversight and less regulation. I mean, Neem and I have been talking about the need for, obviously, for more oversight and more accountability given this history of noncompliance when it comes to 702 and Upstream collection. And when you shift things over to 12333, you have zero oversight by the FISA court and much less oversight even by Congress. So it's actually a problematic shift if that's what's going on.
Yeah, and I think just to talk about 12333 in a little more depth, I mean, this is surveillance that happens purely at the discretion of the president and under presidential policies and directives. And so you have a whole host of surveillance, in fact, likely the authority most used for foreign intelligence collection based on, you know, the documents we've seen. This is surveillance that happens without approval by any court, without any court oversight of any type, based on what we know, it's been used many, many times to engage in bulk surveillance. So you're talking about tapping, you know, cables that serve internet communications throughout the whole world. You're talking about collecting communications to and from entire countries. And so I think the very real concern that Liza has emphasized is the NSA may be, you know, limiting itself in this fashion and really limiting itself only because the FISA courts have forced it to, essentially, not out of any sense of altruism or based on any shift in culture or legal analysis and legal theories. But maybe they will be able to collect those entirely same communications by shifting to 12333 collection, by simply saying, instead of, you know, focusing on tapping a cable as it's coming, information is flowing into the U.S., perhaps we can do that same surveillance by tapping cables or using techniques that involve, you know, areas outside the U.S. And so that is the bigger concern. I also, you know, I would say that we should approach, you know, some of the theories that have been thrown out there about encryption limiting the efficacy of this with caution. It may very well be true. People are using encryption more. That's good from a security standpoint. That's good from a privacy standpoint. But it's important to remember, this wasn't the NSA on its own choosing to reform itself. This was a court very clearly telling the NSA they wouldn't have a program reauthorized because they had had compliance issues. And so, you know, I don't think that we can sort of look at encryption and say that in and of itself has solved the NSA problem and that in and of itself is going to be a solution. It's a very small piece of a larger pie.
And speaking of giving credit, I mean, yes, it might just be that the NSA was pressured by the FISA court, but the top Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, Adam Schiff, has said that the PCLOB had a lot to do with this. That's the Privacy Civil Liberties Oversight Board. In 2014, they actually had a report saying that about collection was a matter of technical necessity, that the NSA had to do it, and that it was so integrated into Upstream that shutting it down would eliminate a substantial portion of that to-from collection and hinder counterterrorism. So that was 3 years ago. Now the NSA is saying not that. And Representative Schiff is crediting the PCLOB with helping to get the NSA to change something, even though PCLOB said what the NSA was doing was at least necessary, if not acceptable. Why is Adam Schiff giving credit to PCLOB? I'm a little confused here.
I actually went back to read the PCLOB report because I had remembered that report as saying that about collection was necessary as a necessary component of upstream collection. And in fact, the language, when I reread it, was slightly more measured than that, but it basically said that about collection was in some ways an inevitable result of upstream surveillance because some significant proportion of to from collection, which is collection of emails or communications to or from the target, would be lost if upstream if about collection were ended. And what the NSA is saying now is different in that the NSA is saying, yes, we're going to lose some to from collection by ending about collection, but we will be able to continue the collection that is most important and has the most value to national security. So in some ways, they were saying the same thing. They were both at PCLOB back then, based on what NSA told them then, and what NSA is saying today, were both saying, if we end about collection, we're going to lose some to from. But the spin that the NSA put on it back in 2014 was, and that will gut the upstream program. Whereas the spin they're putting on it today is, and that leaves us with the ability to conduct the surveillance that is most important to us. So there, something has changed. And I mean, the lesson that I take from it, I mean, maybe the technical capabilities have changed, but the alternative is whenever the NSA says something is technically infeasible or impracticable, you need to take that with a healthy grain of salt.
I want to get Neem out of here on time, but I guess my final question is, part of the debate around 702 has been Privacy Shield. And as we talked about this on the show before, it's the currently kind of tenuous agreement between the United States and Europe that cross-border data flows can continue to occur. And we had, between 2000 and a couple of years ago, Safe Harbor Agreement, which got struck down because companies like Facebook could not reasonably claim that their data were not being surveilled by the NSA. So an Austrian law student named Max Schrems challenged in European court, got that ruling, renegotiated the agreement. It's called Privacy Shield. Not much different about it. But part of the debate has focused on, we need to reform Section 702 in order to preserve the Privacy Shield so that e-commerce and business can continue. That's been like the business side of this argument, aside from civil liberties, and Republicans might not really care whether we're surveilling foreigners, but they do certainly care if businesses are able to operate and if they're able to be competitive in Europe. Does this at all change that argument? Will the ECJ, the European Court of Justice, look at this and say, well, NSA did a significant internal reform that addresses some of our concerns, and that's a step in the right direction, and we're not going to strike down Privacy Shield? Does this change the appetite to reform 702 when it expires in December 31st of this year? Because now we have reform, and the NSA did a good thing, so will people just be less willing to reform the practices?
You know, without further reform and much more meaningful reform, I would say that the Privacy Shield is still in jeopardy. I mean, if you look at the rulings of the court, they were very clear to raise concerns about necessity and proportionality. Is what the surveillance that the NSA is doing necessary and proportionate? Do individuals have the opportunity for redress? Is there effective oversight? And to be frank, all of those issues still raise concerns. Just to give a concrete example, one of the representations the U.S. made to the EU during the Privacy Shield negotiations was that there was robust oversight. And they pointed to the PCLOB to say, look, we have this body that can look at surveillance programs and offer recommendations. The PCLOB is not a functioning body anymore. It doesn't have quorum. It cannot issue reports. And I think that in and of itself is going to raise concerns with the EU, you know, notwithstanding the host of other issues around 702. I think the other issue, I mean, you asked sort of previously, you know, when we look at the PCLOB report, should they be credited with this change? I think one of the concerns that certainly the ACLU had when the 702 report came out was that there were a lot of missing pieces. You know, it's no question that having a PCLOB is certainly better and a step forward in terms of oversight. But when we look at that report, there were lots of data points missing. For example, how many U.S. persons had their information collected under Section 702? That's information that the PCLOB said they asked for and were not able to get. Yet they issued a report essentially, you know, indicating that they felt the program was lawful and appropriate. You know, that in my mind is a huge gaping hole that would make an accurate assessment very difficult. We also now know that there are many members of Congress asking the same questions. And, you know, in theory, there should be a way to get that number. So I think that we have to also look not just at whether the PCLOB is a functioning body and has enough people, but do they have the authority to get the information they need to make an accurate assessment? When we look at the 702 report, I think there are questions about whether they were able to get that information. And even when we look at sort of some of the more recent statements that I think call into question some of the foundations and assumptions the PCLOB relied on. So we have to staff up the PCLOB, but we also have to arm them with the ability to force the intelligence agencies and others to turn over information that is necessary for them to really act as an appropriate oversight body, not just sort of a tangential report. A report writing agency.
Yeah, and how best to staff up the PCLOB and how best to give it the tools to do what it needs to do would make a great topic for a future episode, but we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining. My guests have been Nima Guliani, legislative counsel at the ACLU in DC, and Liza Goitein, co-director of the Brennan Center for Justices, Liberty, and National Security Program. Thanks so much, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Follow us on Twitter and at Tech Freedom. Follow us on Facebook also at Tech Freedom. Let us know what you think of the show. Send us an email at media@techfreedom.org. Find this podcast in the iTunes store, where you can leave us a review because it will help others find the show. Thanks for listening.
The Tech Policy Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.